This talk is about a guided tour to European IT lobbying. I, as some other people in this room, are active in FFII, in the European IT lobbying. We did the software patents debate and were recently also involved in the data retention vote, which was apparently lost. And my aim of this talk is to not to focus on an issue, on a specific issue, but on a general level, explain on how to interact with the European Parliament or European bodies in order to promote your own case. And I wanted to focus on where to find documents, how to retrieve documents, and things like that. But looking at some contributions at this conference. Coming here by train, I made some notes, so I shifted a little bit the focus of my talk. I have also a German paper in the proceedings to this conference. This is this big proceedings paper collection you can obtain at the info desk. A guided tour to European IT lobbying. This means I'll take you step by step through what I think personally is relevant here. So it will basically mean a short introduction. This is what I'm currently doing. 10 commandments. This is what I came up with yesterday when I collected some basic core issues which I think are relevant. Then provide an overview about databases. If the web connection works, give you an idea on how to contribute to consultations and provide other useful input to the European Parliament, which bodies are relevant for promoting your case. And perhaps, I don't know whether the time will be left over, I will focus a little bit on the lobbying environment, what other groups are active in Brussels, often depicted as the lobbyists, the traditional lobbyists, and which are usually referred as the bad guys, those who want to promote monopolies and things like that. But I think they're just other stakeholders, and often they're not very efficient, as we learned from our debate. Now, I made this presentation during the train ride. The case is very simple. There's something like a stone on a hill, and then you have the city here, this Congress city, and there's this arrow, and something pushes against the stone. Perhaps it could be a bird or whatever. And then evil things happen because the stone moves downhill, and you can blame gravity for it. And the problem then is that probably this will create some damage. And this is a view we share among very different IT policy issues. They are somehow started, then they enter Parliament, enter the different European bodies, the Council, the Commission has its say. It's a complicated process, and in the end, there will be some regulation, and this regulation, probably bad regulation, will create damage in your community or in other communities. And so the question is how to avoid this damage. And when you are a kind of superhero, I excuse myself, I'm not that familiar with open office and its capabilities to make nice pictures during a train ride are a little bit limited. But you can interact, do lobbying at different stages. And what I wanted to show with the different size broadness of these arrows is that you need very little power at an early stage of development. But when it runs downhill, so you need more superpower. It's always a question of time and strength. On the one hand, when you are in a debate like the software patents debate, which was started, I think, in 2002, so we had a, and ended in 2005, so we had a long, really long debate and a long time and was delayed and so on, so we had time to organize a movement, to organize ourselves and so on, to create awareness in the community, to discuss it for a very long time with Parliament. And we stopped this directive at the almost the very last step before it crashed into this little city. But what I want, and which is a personal concern of me, is that you have to, when you deal with these issues, stop them in an early stage of development. Because what you don't do in an early stage of development, you have to gain more strength in the later stage of development, which is sometimes difficult. And in the data retention debate, the movement was just not strong enough in the end. And we did our best. We tried to stop it with all our superpowers, but we were not successful. And we don't blame it on ourselves. It was just a complicated and tricky issue. So this is the basic presentation for fun here. Perhaps I back to the second slide. I came up with 10 commandments, and they fit actually on one page, and I think they are very, very important. When you are in a lobbying environment, there are always differences. A difference between interests on the one hand and information on the other hand. Often the assumption is if those decision makers knew what this is all about, if they knew what this directive actually means, then they would decide differently. And of course there's also, and this has somehow to be separated, a difference in interests. Usually a parliament is a very fair representation of interests and interest groups. They are elected, and I know voting is not perfect, but I wouldn't really blame it on the voting procedures. Of course, you can think of a perfect parliament, which would be a kind of random parliament, which means just randomly citizens are selected as MEPs. Then it would be a perfect representation of people, statistically representation of people, because, I get a letter and you were selected as an MEP because of this kind of lotto game. We don't have this random selection of representatives of MEPs. So we have voting rules. Special people are voted, and generally the assumption is that, and my experience of the debate is that Parliament is a very, very good body and that our voting system somehow works. And if there is a problem in democracy, in the system, then it's not because of Parliament, but this problem originates from the whole institutional framework of the lack of checks and balances within the system. On the European level, usually citizens think the European Parliament is really in charge of these legal proposals. But in fact, there's a procedure called co-decision. And this has to be taken like this, co-decision. This is the role of Parliament on the European level. Der Spiegel, a German news magazine, called the European democracy a minor democracy. And my personal belief is that it's true. The European framework is indeed a minor democracy because Parliament is not really in charge. And the Commission, a very important body with 26 general directorates, and 26 commissioners, is not elected by Parliament. And they come up with all these proposals. They are appointed by the governments, these 26 commissioners, by the national governments. And then we have the European Council, who also shares legislative powers with the European Parliament, and which is a second body, and it works similar to Bundesrat in Germany, in a kind of federal system, which actually means that this council, usually this council of ministers, there are people, not really the states are represented, and the states often means the ministers. The ministers on this specific topic are represented in the European Council, like the ministers of interior, or even on a lower level, their staff workers, their staff people, like people from the ministries, from the Ministry of Justice, for instance, in Germany, the Department of Justice in Germany, actually. So Bundestag or national parliaments often have hardly any influence on what is decided in the European Council, because the Council of Ministers, because the Council of Ministers is very intransparent. And there's an institutional struggle on the European level, and these institutions are a little bit unbalanced. Unbalanced in the sense that European Parliament is very weak. So our problem, we always said power to the Parliament, which actually meant that Parliament is the body that has to be strengthened. And Eurosceptics usually tend to, like the UK Independence Party, they usually try to strengthen the national state, because they think on the European level, when the national government represents them on the European level, it gives citizens more say. But the fact is that governments are not really good controlled by national parliaments. This is a problem we especially faced in the software patents debate. Lobbying, what is lobbying about? Some people say information supply, like advertisement, is officially also for information supply. Now, I think it's information supply on the one hand, assisting Parliament to do its job, and to raise stakeholder interest, to demonstrate I represent, say, security professionals, and security professionals want this or that. And we are the specialists. We know more about it than a general MEP, and we provide you with this useful stuff. The Ten Commandments of successful lobbying, this is just a list of 10 points that I think are very important and that you really have to bear in mind when you do lobbying on the European level. The first I already mentioned is start early. Start early in the whole process, in the whole legislative process. Get into it on an early stage of development. And, well, you shall be a kind of a first mover. It's better when you are the first person, the first group who knows about all this, what's going on. And if you report about the issues, if you make the news and discuss it with the community and contribute to consultations, and usually then time is on your side. You have more preparation to prepare your positions and so on, and to gain trust inside Parliament. The second important issue, from my perspective, the second commandment is you should get organized, and especially organized also on a regional level in member states. There are organizations like FFI, like IDRI, which are organized, but there are many in whole Europe, but there are some organizations or some interests which are not even organized. For instance, there's no European Association of Security Professionals, as far as I know. And when you look at the outcome of the legislative process, you clearly see that there were no security professionals involved. So it's very important to organize interests, be it security professionals, be it interoperability, which is an important topic. It's also important that you are present in Brussels. So this is expensive. It's expensive to have a permanent lobbyist in Brussels. But before a vote, it's useful to have about 10 people minimum in Brussels, which just say stay in a hotel and go up and down Parliament and provide voting lists to the MEPs, discuss with them, and so on. So Parliament is generally very open. The third commandment, another talk today in this room stressed the same issue, is that I recommend you to be honest when you advocate. That means that you shall stick to the truth or what you regard as an approximation of your current knowledge of the truth, because it makes advocacy of yourself much easier. It's kind of a psychological issue. When you're convinced about, and when you know, I tell what I know, really know about what I'm convinced about, then you can outperform almost any lobbyist who just promotes a case which is not his own. Someone told me one campaigner is worth 10 traditional lobbyists. And this is certainly true. Perhaps the number has to be corrected even on an upper level. And the real issue is to become a reliable source to these MEPs, provide useful information to them, and create a kind of trustworthy relationship. Generally, MEPs know you better, because so you cannot really masquerade, because there are so many lobbyists which approach them every day, every time. So you get a certain sense as an MEP, you get a certain sense for people, and you easily get whether someone is acting or if someone really defends his own case. And so it's not really good to play tactical games or like that. Usually you gain not much about it. The fourth issue, which I believe is important, is, as a kind of suggestion, you don't have to take literally, but it would be a good advice to try to convince your grandma, because your grandma is probably a person which has goodwill to you, tries to understand you, but probably has not the real capacity to understand why it's important to you. So MEPs are similar. They are often not experts in the issue. They often have goodwill. It depends on their ideology, but generally you can assume that they are not really against you on an ideological level. So in order to train, to promote your case, it's probably the best to try to convince people who are not in the business, who are not in the community, as a test case. And, well, the fifth commandment is to investigate your environment and build a knowledge base about what other groups are doing. Investigate the whole issue. Investigate who's in charge of the whole stuff you're concerned about. And this knowledge base, we found that a wiki system is very suited for it. When you have a community and you collect facts, you collect notes about who's part of that community or who interacts with whom and where to get the source. So a wiki system is very useful. It's very useful to compile information and just to collect it. This Zettelkasten method, so to speak. When interacting, and this is more about how to present yourself. A kind of contradiction is the sixth commandment. This is don't be anti. Don't be the protest movement. Because the problem is always that when you are the anti-movement, then you defend a kind of conservative case. in some areas, it has to be done like this. Like software patents, you have to say, oh, no software patents. But really, this anti-attitude is not really very much convincing because, well, MEPs or decision makers, they want to change things. They don't want to stay like it is. And if you're just defending, you cannot really gain much. You can just destroy the project, so to speak. But interestingly, you can always turn this around. You can always say, we are not against software patents, but we defend the freedom of software development or things like that. It does not work always. Or we defend human rights, or we defend privacy or things like that. You can also always turn this around and create a positive message. And this is often more convincing. You also have to be concerned that in the media, usually there's a standard scheme which somehow gives you an impression how you are regarded in the public, and journalists are usually not really biased. This is usually the strong party, the first party is mentioned, and then there is the first party says we need data retention, and then for balancing, a journalist adds the anti-group and says, but privacy activists say, no, we don't need data retention and it's dangerous. A kind of indicator of where you stand is whether you are whether your interests are the group which is mentioned first or whether your interest is mentioned second. This is somehow related to the seventh commandment. And this is beware of the big guy trap. Big guy, small guy trap. Big guy, small guy is a kind of scheme which is very good to gather supporters, and it's quite dangerous. When you look at some contributions at this conference here, some papers and so on, you often find this big guy, small guy scheme. There are the evil conspirators, the monopolists, whatever. They want data retention, whatever. And then you have the small guys, which are ignored, and therefore democracy is broken, and things like that. The problem is that politicians, while they have sympathy with the small guy, and this is what this scheme somehow plays with, it's in every system, in every community, it's the dominant strategy to side with the big guy, with the more important party. Because in every system, the more important party somehow has to rule. And the other group is the minority opinion. So when there's no reason to depict your own interests as the minority opinion, then simply don't do it. This also applies to the seventh commandment, which I comprehend as don't rationalize. That is, don't say things which you cannot know, because you really don't know it, you just suppose it. You try to rationalize why your opponent wants this, or why the EU starts a legislative project. It's like saying Bush went to Iraq because of oil interests. Actually, I personally don't know whether it was about oil interests. And by doing so, you rationalize, as a mirroring, you rationalize what your opponent does. And often this is associated with a kind of premise. The premise in this Iraq example is that it's immoral to invade a country just because of oil interests. But this premise does not have to be shared among every citizen. And so you have to be very cautious about this. Or like in the software patents debate, many people said, well, Microsoft wants software patents because they want to kill free software. Well, of course, there was one of these Halloween papers which indicated this as an option to destroy free software, but we don't really know whether this is the driving force or the agenda behind. And sometimes I feel that these lobbyists somehow parrot what the other side thinks about it. The ninth commandment is, keep your action under control, or better, know what you do. It's often said in lobbying guides, don't insult MEPs, be kind to them, be friendly, and so on, and dress nice to the common business standards, and so on. But I would rather say it's important that you, for instance, when you insult someone, you don't insult him accidentally or because of an emotion, but because you want it so, because this is your aim to insult him in order to create a certain effect. So try to think about what you are currently doing and whether this is efficient or effective and what effects it will have, and not generally be friendly or things like that. And in many cases, it's very useful not to be friendly, but to hit someone or to push someone in a certain direction. Before the first reading of the Software Patents Directive, Ali McCarthy was heavily targeted by FFRI. And many people inside FFRI thought this was a little bit inappropriate. But the fact was that the vote was obviously won because many people inside Parliament were upset about this particular person, Arlene McCarthy. So this unusual style was, in fact, the appropriate style. And, the tenth commandment is forget lobbying guides. I mean, develop your own style. Do what you think is good. And what we found out was that SME representatives, they somehow magically usually know what to do. They talk to MEPs and they don't obey really to guides or like that. They're used to discuss with customers, and so they can also discuss with other players or other people and MEPs, and they just are themselves and present themselves and present their interests, and they're very good in that. So you don't need lobbying guides, how to behave and things like that. What I would encourage you is, and I think this is important, don't spam MEPs, because MEPs don't like that. We had the problem with this, I think it was from Compact, this tool which sent automatically generated messages to MEPs in one copyright debate. There was a problem with a kind of spam tool of the Electronic Frontiers Foundation, which spammed these MEPs, and this was quite unsuccessful. So I suggest you don't pollute Parliament, because those people acting in Parliament and defending this case get serious trouble when all these MEPs and their co-workers are annoyed because they are spammed with these always the same messages, or get 200 messages a day. It could be a useful issue useful instrument when you don't have access to Parliament. But when you have access to Parliament, this is quite damaging. So this is this was the preface.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Hello. Okay. I have a little question. I've waited that you finish these 10 commands, but I don't know it now yeah, I thought I can wait to it, but yeah, it doesn't help. I don't have a clear picture of the working of a lobbyist. I have in mind, maybe I've watched too much television, that a lobbyist is doing, I don't know, owner of an oil company is going to a regional politician and give him a cover with money in it and tell him, please change the law to give us the right to make a drill station in a natural reservoir, or some kind of this. So my question is, how do you get the connection to this parliament, Therese? And how does the works look like? Are you meeting them in a kind of cafe, or are you going at home to them? Are you make phone calls to them? Are you just emailing? How do you get the access to them, the physical access? How does it look like? A day in Brussels of your work. And the second one is, what is the interest of a parliamentarian to make the connection to a lobbyist like you?
Well, in parliament, they're used to talk to stakeholders in general, because they don't know really about these issues. And so they usually want to get input from specialists. And, well, this is the way it works. Paying MEPs to vote for a certain thing, well, this is corruption. And usually, it depends on the state. I know that there are states where this is quite common, but in the European Parliament, it does not work in that direct way. It's not really that they pay them, but somehow they are the guys with which they hang around somehow. Access to Parliament for citizens is very easy, because they have an office. You can talk to them. They invite you to conferences sometimes, or you have relations to certain groups in Parliament. You always find in almost any group someone who's on your side, and then you try to convince inside Parliament and get these votes together, or you have relations. Of course, it needs you have to be present in Brussels. And we have a lobbyist in Brussels, Erik Josefsson, and he was there for I think 2 years. It's all about to creating this kind of trustful relationship. For you as a conference here, perhaps a relationship could start like you invite an MEP to this meeting here, and he talks about it. Actually, I invited a co-worker from the European Parliament, but she couldn't come. And of course, when you are in the debate, then there are other groups which have access to certain politicians and talk to them. So perhaps we have access to someone, and so we forward something from another group. When you are an important stakeholder in a debate, you somehow just get consulted because you wrote a letter to them, or you talked to them, or anything else. So contacting Parliament is not really a problem. Getting access to the Council or the Commission is more difficult and takes more money. What I collected here are some links to document repositories. I cannot go into it in all the details.
Can you read the URL, please?
Oh no. This page here is wiki.ffi.org/22c3en. I collected all these links. These are different document repositories. The European Union produces a lot of documents in the legislative process, a lot of documents. And actually, the European Parliament, the Commission, the Council, they all have their own document repositories. And they're not only documents from Parliament or from the Commission, but also preparatory documents, questions from parliamentarians to the Commission, and so on. What's important then is that you know how to find these documents, because you cannot just say, I want software patents, but this directive is called Directive on the Patentability of Computer-Implemented Inventions. Or this IPR Enforcement Directive second is named COM, also the original commission proposal is named COM 2005 276 final. So this is a number you have to keep in mind. And then you usually find these documents very easily. These registers improved a lot. The main disadvantage of these registers is that you cannot search them just via Google, full-text search. These files are hidden. So once you find a certain file, download them, save them locally, or save them on the FTP server, because it could well be that you don't find them back, these documents. There are a lot of documents available, talks, preparatory documents. A directive does not just pop up. A directive is prepared with green papers and communications and speeches and so on. And all these are signals that something is going on. I'm a little bit limited in time here, but when you look here, for instance, for data retention, so this is data retention. Then you will find some interesting documents, plenary document, or probably plenary speech, or amendments. Amendments are change proposals. And this is from the parliament, the opinion from the committee, translated in various languages. This is quite interesting, because every official document gets translated into all official languages. Amendments, this is the parliament database, but here we have also a question time, a question from an MEP to we have source author Claude Moraes, addresser cons is council, data retention. Oh, this Word document, I will not open it. But you see here the document date and so on. Interesting additional information you can gather from these documents. E.g., for instance, that an MEP asked the commission and what he asked the commission. And then you can look for the answer of the commission or of the council. And when you know that the parliamentarian asked the question to the council, then you know probably a little bit more about his attitude or that he was concerned about the issue. There are oral questions, official questions. So all these documents are quite interesting from my point of view. And there are also, and you can request almost any document from the European Union. This is interesting because what we are talking about information freedom on the EU level, they have de facto Swedish standards. You can get even documents which are sent from a lobby group to the president of the European Parliament. And he just entered the document, scanned it, entered it into his document database. So you can request this document. If it's not online, then you file a request, say, I want this document, please send it to me, and then you will get perhaps a letter from the commission of this institution, you cannot get this document because it's classified, or you get the document, and usually you get it if it's not online. You can search. Usually these search engines are somehow a little bit complicated, and I personally prefer it to have them downloaded on an FTP server or anywhere else, so you just can plain Google or desktop search, because I always remember what's part in the document, but not what's the real name of it. There are other systems, a document register of the European Union, which you can search, or Prelex. Prelex is an important service to follow a legislative proposal. I will give an example. I said COM 2005 276. search, and here you have it, a proposal for a European Parliament and Council directive on criminal measures aimed at ensuring the enforcement of intellectual property rights. This is the proposal for this IPR enforcement directive. And the other document for framework decision, this was because of this IPR enforcement directive. The second, it was split into two components, but all this, what's described here, is history because it was invalidated by the European Court of Justice, and we expect it to pop up again in January. Now, and then it's explained here. And we have this document, and you see here also other documents, preparatory documents, perhaps studies and things like that proposed by the European Commission accompanied to this process. Very important is who is in charge of it inside Parliament. Usually a directive, when it enters Parliament, it has a rapporteur in a committee. Rapporteur means the person in charge in the committee who prepares the report. And there are also often shadow rapporteurs in the different political groups inside Parliament, which is quite interesting. And you see here, oh, it's transmitted to the Council 12-7, and well, nothing happened since then. And so this directive is a bad example because it's stalled and it's just at the beginning of the whole process. But you can find out, for instance, who's in charge of it inside Parliament, and this is the person which is probably most relevant in which committees of Parliament it will get debated before it's voted in plenary. And usually these groups, these committees, prepare change proposals called amendments to this directive or say, oh, this has to be changed, that has to be changed, and often plenary votes as the group proposed. Now, with the data retention directive, we had it quite the other way around, because the committee had an opinion, but a very strange process. The leaders of the biggest group said, okay, we make a deal with the council and push it through with our majority against what was decided and negotiated in the committee, and which was in charge. So this was quite unusual. But usually these committees are very important, and the rapporteurs. So you don't have to talk to any MEP. And if you talk to an MEP who's not in charge, then he will say, oh, yes, I have this rapporteur in my political group, or I trust him, and he does the opinion of my party, and in the plenary I will vote with him because I trust this person, or things like that. Or perhaps also don't. In European Parliament, there are often very informal relationships you only get aware of when you're long time there. And then there's, of course, also a repository of the Council, which is, from my perspective, the best repository. All these URLs of these search engines are a little bit chaotic. You can also edit them, and there are some tricks to change numbers, and I will not talk about that. And then there's OILEX, which is a service in which law is presented, ratified law which went through this process. The next page I mentioned here, EU Sim Demüst EN, was done by us, or I think by Mirnik, who tried to explain what different shortcuts in a document mean. And what we did, for instance, what's that? Okay. And there are also other documents. This is a staff directory of the European Commission. It's also quite useful. When you meet someone at a conference, he's from the Commission, then you can just look up his name in the staff directory, and then you know where he works, what his position is, whether he's somehow somebody just for the press, or if he's really in charge, and what his role is. This is quite unusual, that this organizational data is that open in the European Parliament, because you can find out so much. Sometimes in other governments, this is really classified data, who's in charge and who does takes which job, this organizational chart. Rules of procedure, the treaties, and so on, are very important in the legislative process to know under which procedure a legislative act is introduced into Parliament. This is very complicated, but it's worth to investigate it, whether it's applied under Article 95 and so on, because these procedural questions decide what you can do, whether you can file amendments, for instance, in the second reading, or what can happen in the second reading. Often national governments, when questioned in national parliaments, don't know the procedures on the European level. They simply don't know. They tell Parliament, well, we will vote in the first reading, but in the second reading we can change it. But when you look at the proposals and the procedural rules, you see that there is no opportunity to do so. It's also interesting, we had a long debate in the European Council because of this difference between A items and B items, which was actually about informal rules. These were not formal rules, and we stressed very much the possibilities according to the written law and interpretation by legal experts. That is that you can agree on a common position, but you can say, okay, this is not our common position anymore. And Council insisted on, once you reach a common position, you have to adopt it. There's no other way, be it in the fishery councils or anywhere, we have to adopt it. And Poland didn't want to adopt it, and so they delayed the process. But also the delay was very useful because it gave us much more time to create the movement to stop this legislative act, finally stop it. So the rules of procedure are very important. Now, what I just want to mention here are two projects. Just have a look at it if you're interested. And there's currently an EU broadcast directive prepared, which could be interesting for podcasting and things like that. I think the Electronic Frontiers Foundation is very concerned about it on the WIPO level, about broadcasting, and they got, I think, 300,000 euro, I think, or like that, for lobbying in this broadcasting area. I don't know much about broadcasting, but the Commission proposed 13 September, I think, a similar directive. I just had a look at it. It's interesting because at one point it says that a new service, media service, you may not insult someone or things like that. This is very general. I can look it up. You may not something against religious beliefs and things like that. So we don't have a Fortzensur in Germany. So it's a little bit wacky on the constitutional level, but I don't know how it works. Data retention, you know, this one through. This is a Slashdot article because a comment of our president, Peter, which I think is very interesting here. This was our press release, and Peter says, ironically, a report by the Commission just 4 years ago on the echelon surveillance system stated quite clearly that only in a police state is the unrestricted interception of communication permitted by government authorities, and he concluded the EU is now officially a police state by the Commission's own words. So this went through, and this went wrong. Now, these other quotes relate to how to contribute not only inside Parliament, but better before it enters Parliament. And there are consultations, there are very interesting consultations, and I really encourage you, when you represent an initiative, if you represent an NGO, or even a company, or just you as a person and have time, draft a paper of 10 pages or like that, contribute to consultations, because show up as a stakeholder who's interested. And there's a page, Your Voice, it's named Your Voice, with a lot of different consultations mentioned. Not all consultations show up on the main page, but in the pages of the specific general directorates, you find more consultations. And here's, for instance, a call for input on the forthcoming review of the EU regulatory framework for electronic communication and services, including review of the recommendations on relevant markets. So it could well be that you're concerned about it. Or there's another very interesting consultation. This is Digital Libraries of InfoSoc. And this is actually about that the EU somehow wants to reinvent the Project Gutenberg. And they want to spend 30 millions on that, scanning books and projects and like that. And this is a consultation. And interestingly, the paper of the working paper and the communication is almost, say, 90% on your side somehow. When you are in this this business of in this interest of say Project Gutenberg or things like that. So I really encourage you to contribute to this consultation. I think it's very important here, because the result of this consultation will be that sometime, perhaps in 1 year, perhaps in 2 years, a directive will get proposed. And when you show up as a stakeholder who says, well, I represent the Blinds Union, and it's important that we get interoperability provisions for the blind and things like that, then the likelihood that it will be included before it enters Parliament will be not low. And other groups will show up. I think that all official, those lobbyists which are present in Brussels, like the BSA or CompTIA and so on, all these groups will contribute here and just send a 3-page or 4-page paper. These papers are often not very good, but you show that you have interest in it and you raise certain issues. So this Digital Libraries consultation, I think, is very, very useful. And actually, this is one presentation, one consultation where you are able to kick the stone somehow and roll it down the other way off the hill. And there are other consultations. Everybody can contribute here. You just have to know that this exists here. A consultation on postal services. This might not be really relevant, but sometimes it's useful to just have a look. Like there were consultations about airports. Perhaps there are some relevant questions, like how passenger data shall get tracked or things like that. And then you can contribute with your knowledge and say, oh, these solutions don't work, and be concerned about these interests and care about privacy or whatever. Often the Commission does not know on the one end what the other end is doing. So, and you cannot also say that the Commission is a kind of uniform body. It's different general directorates, different styles, different people, different way of procedures. Just when you look at the different communication of them, they all have a different style. So it's always useful to contribute when you're invited to contribute. Another tool, which of course can be used. Oh, I have something else here. Also interesting, call for input on the forthcoming review, okay, electronic communications, deadline 31 of January. And this one here, Action for Damages, 19th December, adopted a green paper and a commission staff working document on damages, actions for the breach of European Community antitrust rules. So, the public consultation will last at 21st of April. So perhaps you want to comment on antitrust rules, those who are always so concerned about monopolies. Perhaps there's something they want to say about it or contribute here.
I have one question more.
Yeah.
One more thing I'm interested in. I hear about the words you say that the influence is quite big, the influence of lobbying work, when you look at the decisions. So I find it a nice idea because it's kind of private, organized democracy, because you and your organization are not there because any state told you or any government told you to go there. So it's just because, I don't know, like I think you and the guys who are there have a kind of ideology. Yeah, I think of a personal idea to go there. Mm-hmm. But is the question, is there a danger that somebody who has just the money, for instance, a company, it's quite easy to say, if I was the owner of a big company, to say, okay, I will spend this and this amount to send 20 of my workers to Brussels, mm-hmm, to make influence, to make the interest, to make the decision to get nearer to my interests. What do you think? Is there a danger?
Well, of course it happens. Everybody tries to defend its own interests, and also these groups show up in Parliament. But I have to tell you that professional lobbyists are often not very, those traditional lobbyists are often not very efficient in what they are doing. That means you often overestimate their role. They're just there. I think they contribute to the, such consultations. But you, as an ordinary citizen with almost no resources, and I think a professional lobbyist gets 500 euro a day or an hour sometimes. So these are real professional people, public relations people. But you, as an ordinary citizen, can just contribute a paper and outperform them. So this is interesting. So you don't have to be afraid, really, of this. Usually it's a lot of wasted money in this whole process. And the software patents debate showed that they wasted millions on lobbyists and influencing Parliament. But your concern, I think what's really important is transparency, to talk about what they are doing inside Parliament, to talk about these lobby groups. In Germany, we had this case with Microsoft's Hunzinger group, and finally this lobby group became the news, and when it became the news, it somehow broke down commercially. So lobbyists also don't like it when you talk about them and what they are doing and what they are acting and monitor them. And so this is exactly what you shall do. You shall talk about lobbyists. Unfortunately, I'm not able to talk about lobbyists in the given time now. I just want to mention three issues.
Can I just make a proposal that we meet tomorrow? Hello, can you make the microphone?
No, it's too much.
Sorry.
Check. Okay. Regarding the time we have left, perhaps we can meet tomorrow at 11 at the workshop area at the end of the Hack Center or at the last day. I think there are some free slots for meeting for people who are interested in lobbying, not even a European but a German or a regional parliament. That would be perhaps a nice idea to continue the work and the information exchange.
Okay. You can look up the links. I just want to enter one small issue. The Euro Ombudsman. Many people ask us about the European Ombudsman. Generally, you can say in legislative processes, the Ombudsman is irrelevant. and it's not really an effective instrument. So when you have a concern about a policy issue, don't go to the ombudsman. You can file petitions to the European Parliament. You can write a petition. This is especially good for proactive work. A petition takes about six months as a proactive measures, and then you can get the index of your members of parliament from your nation or from other nations and approach them in the private your local MEP or from a different political party. Talk to them. In Germany, we have 99 German MEPs, members of the European Parliament, and you can talk to them, and they are usually very open. You can also invite them to conferences and things like that, establish relations to them. The other links here, down here, this is just these tools, because they are relevant. Most bad issues that happened in the past went through the channel of the EEF. And the AEF is a somehow strange organization. Have a closer look at this organization. It's an association of MEPs inside Parliament, key MEPs inside Parliament. And this group is financed by industry contributors. So MEPs can only get political members. They have a board of 12 members, and Every MEP who ever got invited to a dinner party gets somehow a member of this group. And they have a lot of events. And here you see Charlie McCreevy was invited to 27. And there are business members. And when you look at the business members, these are the business members and associate members. I think also Idri was an associate member. And there are all those relevant people. This is a strange organization. It's an organization built like MEP groups, informal MEP groups on the other side of the Atlantic. Transatlantic Policy Network is another organization of a similar style. I think this organization is somehow a kind of outspring of it. Kangaroo Group on an upper level. And interesting is also... these organizations are just interesting to monitor what they are doing, and have a look at it, perhaps even get a member of these organizations. And Friends of Europe is also interesting as an organization, because they have a lot of access to Parliament. I don't have the time to talk about the interesting issue of journal lobbying. A good for American... lobby groups, a good transparency page is SourceWatch. I really can recommend it. Just have a look at the page about Tech Central Station, and then they tell you that Tech Central Station is part of the DCI group and things like that. And the other interesting issue is that the Commission itself starts currently under Commissioner Kallas. I think he's the Greek commissioner. Starts a transparency initiative, so registration for lobbyists or things like that, more monitoring, more transparency, that they lay open their accounts and things like that. I just stop here. Perhaps we can meet tomorrow again or outside the conference and exchange other views. And tomorrow there will be another talk in the morning. Of me with Tonnerre, or of Tonnerre with me, better. and we will talk about software patents and the next steps in the debate. I'm sorry, it was a little bit much content. And have a look at this linked list. I think it's useful as a short introduction. So I say good night.